Good morning, good afternoon. Thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants' lines are open. Please mute yourself when not speaking by either pressing mute button or star six on your phone. Press star six again to unmute. Today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now we will turn the meeting over to Mr. Schwartz. Please go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. And hello, everyone. Welcome to today's ZFA Advisory Group conference call. I think we've got a pretty full agenda, which, for those that are signed on to the Adobe link, is currently displayed. So I think we ought to get right to it. Before taking the role and acknowledging the folks that are on the phone, I'd like to personally thank Rod and Dave and John and Mark and all the folks that have been participating in the subgroups and commenting on the various models and documents that have been posted in the last few days. A lot of great work has come together. Certainly started back in December when we first gathered, but in the last couple of weeks, it just seems like it's kicked into really high gear and a lot of good dialogue. I think a lot of good material for our next deliverable associated with the applicant guidebook, which we'll talk about a little bit later in the agenda. But an appreciation and an offer of thanks to everyone who's participating and who's taking a lot of time to produce those documents. So moving along to the agenda, let me quickly acknowledge the folks that are on the call. We obviously have myself, we have Tatiana, we have Susan Prosser, John McCormick, Nacho Amadoz, Mark McFadden, Vladimir Shadrinov, Barry Cobb, Tom Barrett, Francisco Arias, Rick Wilhelm, John Levine, and Dave Piscatello. Have I missed anyone? Hearing none. And I don't think we're going to be joined by Rod today. I could be wrong, but I think he may be traveling. If someone actually knows more about that, if you could chime up, that would be great.
He's on his way back from Hong Kong, so he wasn't certain he'd be landing in time for the call.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think he said he was getting in at right about 8:30 Pacific time, which is now, and that he would join us when he could. So moving on through the agenda, I thought it would be a good idea for Mark to spend a few minutes acknowledging and talking about the couple of comments that came in kind of right after our call last week or right after the deadline. The comment form is now closed. The summary is posted. And Mark, do you want to talk about the last couple of comments that you received?
Sure. Thanks, Craig. As Craig said, the summary or my summary is actually posted as the last entry in the public comment form. And you can find that it's actually pretty quick if you just link to the public comments that are on the ICANN homepage. It's easy to find. The last two, I'm sorry, I was just getting an echo there. I'm going to turn down the volume here and see if it's me. The last two comments that we got were from the registry stakeholders group. I'll talk a little bit about that. And then another comment from GoDaddy.com. And while there's 15 minutes set for the agenda for this item, I'm not going to take nearly that amount of time. Let me say a few words about what the registry stakeholder group said. First of all, they had a strong preference of the enhanced bilateral model. They identified two main objectives that they thought were crucially important for any zone file access system. And one of the objectives was that registries have to be able to know who it is that is gaining access to the ZFA data. And second of all, something that the registries have said many times, the ability to actually close down zone file access in the event of abuse. So they really reiterated those things, and they expressed substantial support for the work that John's subgroup has been doing, the idea of standardizing and providing standardizing the protocol data formats on the one hand, and then also establishing best practices for timing of updates and procedures for customer support and so forth. Another thing the registry set affects our work and certainly affects the agenda today is that they said that they questioned whether or not this had to be built into the applicant guidebook. And quoting them, they said, considering the very low level of real demand and the significant costs of running the Zone File Access Program and the availability of alternative solutions, they asked the question, really makes sense to add a ZFA through regulatory measures. That was one of their comments in the middle of comments. Another thing that's important that the registry stakeholder group said was about the bilateral model. They identified three items that might benefit from more flexibility than is currently given to them. And those three items, the three items are the timing of the updates, how often you actually saw the zone file data, two, the procedures for customer support, and three, the security-related procedures. Well, I think, and not to comment on the comments, but, and in fact, it's probably not my place, but one of the things to note is that in our agenda for today's call, really all three of those are sort of parts of our discussion. So our discussion fits with these comments very well. Finally, the registry constituency addressed each one of the models that was provided in the concept paper, and they make some remarks about each one. And I won't take time to go over each one, but the last part of the registry stakeholders group comments were directed at each one of the particular models, and they had suggestions. Most importantly, in terms of summarizing, is once again their preference for the enhanced bilateral model. GoDaddy was the last organization to submit comments in the ZFA concept paper public forum. And their comments were slightly shorter. They had some interesting things to say about the repository model and the proxy model, saying that it might be possible in the event of those models to actually come up with some historical centralized zone data, and that might be a product that emerges out of having cached copies over a period of time of the zone file data. And GoDaddy suggested that if a third party was acting as a zone file access provider, they asked the question, should the operator of such a system be able to market that? And if they were able to market that or other byproducts of having the zone file data, GoDaddy, in comments, insisted that any such marketing had to have the approval of the ICANN community and the ICANN board. GoDaddy also said that one of the things that is a feature of the Zone File Access System currently is that it's available to accredited registrars at no charge. They wanted to see that continue. The last thing that GoDaddy really said was that any enhancement of a cost model, I said that wrong, their exact words are, we recognize the operational benefits of centralized zone data access for registrars and other consumers, but are wary of advocating new cost structures where none exist today. Okay. So I think what GoDaddy was driving at is that we have to be very thoughtful and careful about whatever funding model we might put in place and how it affects the cost models for consumers of the data. Yeah. Those are the last two comments that came in, and last week I reviewed the comments that had previously arrived. Once again, I have in the public forum posted a copy of all of my summary and the sort of summary goes with it in the standard form that ICANN uses in these public forums. I can post it to the mailing list, but it would probably be better for me to do, and will do this, is just post a link to this particular document so that you can see it for yourself. And now, Craig, I'd be happy to take questions. Not sure there'll be any, but if there are any, I'm happy to take them.
Is there question? Are there questions or discussion about the comments?
Great.
Hearing none. Why don't we move? We'll move on to item number three, which is the review of the last informal survey on the model options. And so Mikey O'Connor posted the survey last week. We asked people to respond by Friday. It looks like out of the group, there were 14 responses. There were 6 votes for the enhanced bilateral plus clearinghouse. There were 5 votes for enhanced bilateral by itself. There were 2 votes for the enhanced bilateral plus the repository model. And there was one person who made a comment, but it doesn't look like there was a vote. So we've got really 13 votes, almost evenly split between enhanced bilateral with clearinghouse and enhanced bilateral just on its own. So to follow up on that, and I wonder if there are questions or comments that anyone on the phone would like to make now about those survey responses or the survey results.
This is Barry.
Hi, Barry.
Good morning. I guess one that voted for the hybrid model, the enhanced and the clearinghouse, I would just be interested in hearing those that only voted for just the enhanced bilateral, what gaps do we need to fill in to kind of bring them over to the hybrid model, if you will, because I think if we found those gaps immediately, then we're definitely on our golden path to a consensus. Certainly, we're definitely on the consensus realm for just the enhanced bilateral as a standalone, but I do think that there are a lot of benefits to gain with the clearinghouse. Thank you.
This is Vladimir. I voted for the enhanced bilateral model. I'm obviously not against the hybrid enhanced bilateral plus clearinghouse in the sense that if we have the clearinghouse as light as possible, meaning that probably Dave Piscatello made a good suggestion to the list about the possible option here. I think if ICANN could manage this process, this would result in a hybrid that I would personally, in my personal capacity, would probably support.
Yeah, this is John Levine. May I?
Yes, John, please.
Yeah, I mean, the clearinghouse was my idea in the first place. I mean, and my goal was always to have it be an extremely lightweight thing that simply relieved the burden of application of signing and reviewing the applications. You know, and the intention was that it would sit on top of whatever process was already there or whatever different process we have. So from my point of view, very lightweight was always part of the idea.
Thanks, Sean. As everyone can see on Adobe right now, I've lost connectivity, so I'll get that back as quickly as possible. I think it would be good to hear from some other folks if they're willing to speak, those that voted purely for the enhanced bilateral. I know Barry's sentiments about trying to identify what the gaps might be, because as I raised on the list last week after Rick Wesson made his comments, I'm not sure how purely an enhanced bilateral versus a hybrid. It doesn't seem to me that it addresses the scalability issue, which is one of the roots, which is one of the roots of how this group came to be. So I'd like to hear more about that if people are willing to speak up.
Folks, this is Britt Weston finally joining.
All right.
Good morning.
Did you want to speak up, Rick, or are you just identifying yourself?
I was identifying myself and letting other people chime in before I did. have some problems with our definition of scalability issues. There were a number of assertions that were made in the initial document that outlined all of these different models. And the assertions that were made in that document, I actually don't believe have been proven. And so my concern is anytime that we create new structures within ICANN, that those structures need oversight and cost money, and having not actually made the case, there are assertions that are out there that the particular model that we have doesn't scale or won't scale, and I'm not completely convinced of that. And so that's where my issues lie.
Thanks, Rick.
It's Mark. Maybe I could respond to that. Rick, I think one of the things that was presented as some evidence for the existing model to not scale is the original cost model that was done with Mikey that showed that the introduction of new TLDs and pick the number that you want, whether it's 100, 300, 500, 1,000, the introduction of new TLDs ended up incurring substantial costs to the consumers of the data. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the cost model. But
I actually have gone into some detail with Mikey about it. But if you could just identify one of the costs, that would help. The largest cost in your mind to the consumer of this data.
Well, what about legal fees and just legal overhead to process contracts? And if I have, this is Dave Piscatello, if I've got 15 contracts and my attorney charges me $300 an hour to review a contract and it costs an hour of his time each year, 15 times 30 is manageable. If it's 100 times 30, it becomes fairly noticeable in my budget, and if it's 200, it becomes even more so.
If I could just point out that every domain name, there is a contract between the registrar and registrant for every domain registry.
Right, but typically, but what is the point there? I'm sorry, it's a big leap from what we're talking about.
Oh, no, I don't think it's a big leap. There are contracts that are executed, many times a day for much less.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Sure. So, Dave, my point is that the contracts between a registrant and a registrar, which is certainly a contract, is executed for every domain name ad. And so I'm just merely pointing out that there are scalable mechanisms that can be put in place to, show that an agreement exists between two parties. And that happens many times a day in a field that we're all familiar with.
Well, I don't want to belabor this because I don't see that the analogy is equivalent. In one case, I'm a business operator who is going to be dependent on a particular form of access for what is essentially one of my mission critical activities. So if I'm internet identity or I'm one of the other people who relies on this feed to protect my brands, and it goes away, I'm in a lot more world of hurt than I am if I'm speculating on domains and one of them goes away.
So if you're talking about service level issues around accessibility to the zone file, I certainly think that there are mechanisms that we could put in place that would ensure that we have better access and reliability around access.
And I guess that's why I like what John Levine's proposed as a clearinghouse. I don't see this as being something heavy and preponderous. I see this as being something that provides an assurity that I have one contract irrespective of whether I'm dealing with 5 or 500 TLDs. You asked for one example. I gave you one. I'm sure that there are other operational issues that similarly don't scale in terms of managing connections to a variety of things that Rod pointed out in the original paper. If you have an issue with them, in some respects, you could also try to prove the negative.
We've got a bit of a queue growing for people, that would like to talk. So I think Dave and Rick could probably go back and forth for a little while, but let's give some other folks an opportunity to talk. And I see John Levine would like to speak.
Yeah, thanks. I believe that at this point I'm still the only person with ZFA access to every active domain. And I can tell you that by far the largest cost to me is my time figuring out where to apply and going back and forth with the agreements and making sure that I adjust to the nits in the agreements that are different. And it is a continuing burden. I mean, for example, earlier this week, I realized that .biz was switching from HTTP access to FTP access. So I had to go back and forth with email, and I had to fill out a new application, blah, 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 blah. So that's why I met at the clearinghouse. So basically, the reason that the contractual issues for domains is not a problem is that once you've signed up for the first domain with the registrar, the next million domains are all the same contract. So with the clearinghouse or something like it, once you've signed up for one zone, then all the other zones are the same and there's no more review. So I think we're actually in agreement here. Basically, the administrative overhead at both ends is the only thing that seems to be worth trying to address. Nobody seems to be complaining about the cost of the bandwidth, enormous though it is.
Are there others that would? Hey, Rick. Rick Wilhelm would like to speak.
I didn't think I'd get to the queue so quickly. So I think that one of the things you're pointing out there is that the things like where to apply and the agreement and things like that, those are problems that are more difficult to bracket what the cost of the solution is going to be, whereas issues related to the things like the bandwidth and the technical infrastructure are in the domain of the rational and able to be solved with computers and technology, technical cleverness and things like that. Whereas some of these notions about where to apply and standardizing the agreement are more difficult to sort of put bounds around. Is that sort of kind of what you're getting at?
I'm sorry, Rick, who are you directing your question to?
I think that was Mark that was... No, I'm sorry. John Levine was... That was talking just prior to me?
Yes, John. John, are you on mute?
Oh, sorry, I was warming up my coffee.
Rick, can you restate your question?
Sure. So I think that the point behind the enhanced bilateral is that standardizing on the agreement, standardizing on where to apply, and some of these things that are not solvable via technical solutions. They don't succumb to technological cleverness. Whereas that addresses those things that are more difficult to solve. Whereas things like the bandwidth and the scripting and things like that are more easily solvable by technical cleverness. And so, in other words, put the effort in standardization making things more common around the problems that are less difficult to get one's hands around.
I was with you until you got the less difficult. Standardization is. There's some administrative issue. I think if we simply tell new domains, here's what the standards are, when you build your ZFA, they'll say okay. And that will be that. I don't see it as a big deal, but I do see that You know, if we can build our tool, I mean, it's, you know, it's obvious. If we can build our tools once rather than 300 times, it's going to be a huge savings for everybody.
Yeah, when we were talking about, I think we covered this a little bit last week, and one of the points that I believe I made was around the fact that we would anticipate, I'm going to anticipate that a number of the new registries are going to be operated by the existing back ends. People like Phileas and Newstar and whatever. And so consequently, it's not all of these new registries are not going to be greenfield technical implementations. And the objection that we're going to hear from the existing registries is that forcing them to change something which about the like the file format and things like that, which, you know, seem to work well enough already, I think that's going to raise a fair amount of objections.
Well, I mean, we won't know until we try. But the reason I'm not worried about it is twofold. One is that I've tried to standardize the standardizing stuff that we've suggested is for the most part very close to what the big registries do already. And the other is that, I mean, if you look at the four domain files that come from Phileas or the multiple files that come from Newstar, they're not all identical. I mean, so they clearly already have some ability to customize the stuff for the registries. So if we ask them to do one more customization, you know, and promise that we'll never ask them to change it again, I don't think we're going to get all that much pushback from them.
Barry, I think you're next in the queue.
Thank you, Craig. You know, I guess I'm kind of coming in through an echo, so I hope you can hear me okay.
We can.
Okay. You know, I definitely, I guess in some respects, I do have to agree with what Rick was saying, that, you know, if we, you know, did lay down the standards and the standards applied to all registries that provided the zone files and those kinds of things, there's definitely a lot of optimization that can be gained there. But still with the clearinghouse model, which I'm still in favor of, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there would also be some very good benefits to be gained with respect to vetting the access to the zone files. If I recall correctly, you know, there was issues as to who's accessing the zone files, how they're gaming the system if they did get knocked down for abuse, and those kinds of things. And I'm just wondering, you know, still in terms of vetting who has access and that one-stop shopping ability to get the access across the varying TLDs, isn't there still benefits to be had in that regard?
Rick Wesson, I'd like to get in queue on that.
Go ahead, Rick.
If we have an entity that is providing access, essentially authorization, they may not have the transparency to understand where abuse is occurring. And since many times we don't know what abuse is until we experience it, an entity in the clearinghouse model may not have the kind of information to make those kinds of decisions. And so one of the issues that's going to come up is where you have a TLD that can be gamed in some way. I'm not saying that I know how that is done today, but a new game. And so it comes back to authorization and access. And how a TLD would communicate to the clearinghouse that this entity shouldn't have access any longer? And would that trickle down to other TLDs? And how is that decision made? And potentially, if there's a marketplace for all this information and an entity is able to figure out a game to collect, that they could just go to the marketplace if one... they are denied access through the clearinghouse. So I find that a number of these potential gains from the clearinghouse, they create issues in policy and issues around how different TLDs would communicate access or a denial of access to an entity, especially once there's a marketplace for this information, where someone that has a game just go to the marketplace, and now you can't tell who that actor is anymore, much less prevent them. So, you know, we're going to have to figure out those kinds of issues if we have one of these clearinghouses.
And they don't exist today? Isn't the threat just distributed?
I'm sorry, Dave, could you repeat your question?
I said I'm having a hard time understanding how they don't exist today, you know, where the threat is simply distributed.
Who is they?
The threats that you're just talking about, you know, going through the marketplace, doing aftermarket, you know, all the things that you are describing seem to me that they're no different, you know, simply because there's a clearinghouse. I think that's a pretty big jump.
Okay.
I'm sorry,
Dave. I just don't understand what you're getting at.
It would be helpful if what you would do is post to the list, you know, the threats that you perceive, you know, or the issues that you perceive that we're going to create with a clearinghouse that don't exist today, and explain
okay.
why they don't
okay.
exist.
Well, I'm not an advocate of the clearinghouse.
I'm saying that since you're not an advocate, it would be helpful to identify the threats that you claim that the clearinghouse creates, because I just don't see them being unique to the clearinghouse.
Okay.
And this is Barry. If I may make one additional comment.
Sure, Barry.
Great, thank you, Craig. The clearinghouse model does open up, a two-way street in terms of the pros and cons of what the implementation would look like, especially with the discussion of the registry stakeholder group's comments relative to how a clearinghouse, you know, what. How they would control who has access and take down procedures if they recognized abuse. And we'd certainly need, any clearinghouse model would certainly need to have the proper process and procedures in place for that two-way communication between the clearinghouse and the respective registries. You know, especially things like, I give the FTP access to .com/.net to Joe User. I need to communicate to .com/.net that Joe User is now an access or some method by which maybe VeriSign would log into that clearinghouse facility to see who all is accessing their system. So that two-way street communication would definitely be very, very important to have. The comment that I really wanted to make, though, kind of on the not necessarily the con side of the clearinghouse, but the one-stop shopping, while it makes it very convenient for having the ability to gain access to the multiple zone files that we'll see down the road, the problem is, you know, a brand new user coming in like myself, I've only kind of reviewed some of the contracts to gain access to the zone file. I haven't quite done it yet because I don't have the systems to start pulling down the FTP or anything. In the near future, I'd like to do that. But I'm a brand new user to zone files. If in the clearinghouse model I have the ability to now one-stop shop for all of them, would it be a good practice to let a new user such as myself get access to every zone file immediately? Or, you know, is there certainly a further vetting that would need to go on, or do I need to earn my stripes to be able to gain access to the entire zone files across the world? You know, some of those things definitely need to be thought out.
Hey, Barry, this is Craig. You know, one of the things that we've talked about, I think, since the beginning of the formation of this group is not substantially changing the information, not substantially changing how information is made available, or actually, let me rephrase that. Right now, there's no real vetting of consumers when they want zone file access. They complete this Appendix 3 to whatever TLD agreement they're interested in. And we've heard the registries all say that there's really no vetting, there's really no follow-up, there's really not even, you know, ask about intended use, which are things that a lightweight clearinghouse model could do. I mean, it might actually give us some more interesting data about the reasons for access and the use, and I think that's another discussion. But I don't think the intent is to make it any more difficult for consumers to get access than it is now. And so I'm not sure that I see that a new consumer needs to be vetted any more than an existing consumer. And if folks have thoughts contrary to that, I'd actually be interested to hear about it.
And if I can just respond real quickly, look at John Levine's time and effort that he has spent. You know, he's had to earn his way to get access to all of those models. So there's definitely an intent for him to spend that time and effort to do so. For the casual user, like Mikey has admitted on the call in the past, he was just kind of playing around with it. And, you know, was able, and he only was able to do it with one TLD, and then he kind of gave up because he didn't really know what he was doing. So I was just saying that, you know, a new user coming in that could apply to have 500 FTP IDs through the clearinghouse model would very easily maybe just give up after the first or second one, and, you know, then we're just kind of spinning the wheels, and we don't really need to carry it on much further. I definitely agree where you're coming from, Craig. I just kind of see it as a potential, not a threat necessarily, but kind of an inefficiency, if you will. Thank you.
Thanks, Craig.
This is Vladimir. Craig, I disagree in some way that registries are now not vetting the users because users submit their signed agreements to the registries, and then it's the registry's choice whether to sign an agreement in response or not to sign. So therefore, there is a vetting process at the moment.
That's not the way it's supposed to work, Vladimir.
Can I elaborate? Sorry?
I'm sorry, can you what?
What did you say, Craig? Can you talk a bit more?
Yeah, right now, and the registries have said this, in their responses, that there's really no vetting, there's very little monitoring unless there are signs of abuse or malicious use. But right now, if a consumer signs the zone file access Appendix 3 to a registry agreement, it's in its registry, they're supposed to get access. It's not, to the best of my understanding, and I need to confirm with our counsel, but registries don't have the ability to say yes to consumer A and no to consumer B. They're all supposed to be treated equally. And access is supposed to be provided as long as the consumer or the access requester agrees to the terms of the access agreement.
Well, some of the applications say, what are you planning to use it for? And if you were really stupid, you could say, I'm going to sell it to spammers. But so long as you have enough sense to, you know, to write something generic like follow domain trends, then yeah, they will approve all of them. So, you know, so in theory there is vetting, and, you know, and hypothetically you could imagine them turning somebody down, but in practice I'd be astonished if they ever did.
And some registries have said that they don't even ask that question because it doesn't really matter. They're required by contract to provide access.
Yeah, in fact that's one of the few places where the agreements are different. Some of them have it already filled in, some of them let you do it.
Okay.
Craig, this is Barry, and I'll shut up after this. But I guess, you know, it kind of ties back to the overarching umbrella of why this advisory group was started, and that was to minimize or mitigate the malicious use and or malicious abuse out there. And And I'm sure we don't want to march down this road, but I'd just like to say that if we're not vetting users one way or another, and I'm not sure what that protocol would be or if it's even really possible, but it just seems like it makes it much easier to conduct abuse with use of zone files if we aren't vetting users. Thank you.
Thanks, Barry. So I think this might be a good time to move on with the agenda, and I don't see that Rod. Actually, I do see that Rod has joined us. Rod, do you want to talk about the cost model, or do you want us to move on to item 5 and come back to you?
Yeah, you have to move on. I'm still in. I haven't cleared through immigration.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought. So the next item 5, and Mark has pulled together this formulating a ZFA draft proposal, which is the document that we're going to deliver to ICANN for inclusion, not verbatim, but for inclusion in the way of content for the next version of the guidebook. Mark, let me get your paper put up.
Okay.
And I will, is this Dave's or is this...
It's Dave's.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's mine. On the agenda, if you'll bear with me, let me make a personal observation. What I saw in the last, say, 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, is sort of an emerging trend, both in the conversations on the phone and also on the mailing list, that and also, to be honest, in the comments in the public forum, that a consensus might be reached if we work hard at developing standards for both access and transport of the data, as well as having a clearinghouse model for authentication and authorization to address scalability issues. Basically, addressing the scalability issues in a way that solved the problem on the consumer end and standardized the deployment at the provider end. And so I reflected on that, and a couple other people have reflected on that, and what I thought of, and this was several weeks ago, was that perhaps what we as a group needed, or what would be a constructive model to start from, is a description of how that hybrid model worked. Instead of actually sort of walking around the models and voting, thanks, that's perfect right there, Craig. What I thought, and this was not just my thought, but other people have come to this conclusion as well, that maybe what we need is a document that sort of describes one possible approach to, in some detail, one possible approach to solving the ZFA, provision dilemma. And if I were to outline such a proposal for the people who are on Adobe Connect, the section that's marked a proposed approach here is how you might go about it, that it would be something that has probably three parts. The first part would be something that in clear language describes, number one, the roles of the parties that are involved, number two, the relationships between them, and number three, a process model. I think Rick Wilhelm earlier today was talking about, well, how would the parties talk to each other, and what would be the two-way, conversation, you know, the rules for engagement between the parties. I think it's very important to actually document that and document how the process flows would work for something that looked like a clearinghouse model. But you would have to add that to other things, I think. One is a description that John's subgroup has worked hard on, and that is a description of how the access technologies would work. And second of all, a standardized mechanism for describing how the data would look, and sort of a look at the actual provisioning process, both in terms of transport and what was being transported. And finally, for the clearinghouse model to work, you would also have to have some description of what the identity management system would look like, you know, how you actually bring new consumers into the system, how you authenticate them and authorize them, and then how do you actually go about doing the credential management, and then finally access provisioning in a secure environment. The good news here is that as a group, we have John's subgroup that's worked on the second item of these three, and Dave contributed earlier this week a draft, a detailed draft of how the identity management system might work. And what I tried to propose was a first draft of what the roles and relationships might look like, trying to provide a crisp definition of what a ZFA consumer was, a ZFA data provider was, and what the clearinghouse was, and also a description of what the relationships were between them. My goal here, and it's really a proposal to the group. It isn't this. This isn't really my baby in any way, but it's a proposal to the group of having something very concrete to look at, and that in the end, maybe in May sometime, we'd have a single document that combined these three things, a roles, relationship, and process flow, a document, a description of the standardization, the bilateral standardization activity that we have, and the identity management tools. And so what I'm doing today is I'm actually proposing that that be a way to move forward. It's consistent with many of the things that we've talked about in the past. It also gives us a chance, as we start to talk about each one of the three pieces, it gives us a chance to actually talk about the things, for instance, like Barry was talking about earlier today, identify those gaps where a hybrid approach makes more sense than simply an enhanced bilateral approach. And so that's the background, Craig. I think the next item on the agenda was to sort of hand this off first to John so that he could talk about the work that the standardization subgroup worked on. I'll come back to my roles and relationships paper a little later, but I think first on the agenda, we sort of were going to have John talk first, then Dave, and then me. So I'll hand it back to Craig.
Yep, hi, and I will have that other file up in 1 second.
While Craig's working on that, I don't know if the group has any questions about sort of the outline that I provided there or the intentions. When Craig has a chance to talk about what's needed for the advisory group, or I'm sorry, for the applicant guidebook, there are too many AG acronyms. When Craig talks about the Attorney General, then you'll see sort of how these two sort of dovetail. Maybe we can bring that up later, and we'll just let John go ahead and talk about this particular standardization paper.
Nice segue, Mark. Thanks, John. Do you want to? Why don't you spend a little bit of time kind of walking us through, you know, at a high level, you know, where we are, and it sounds like there's been some violent agreement amongst the contributors to this that we're headed in the right direction. But I think for the benefit of the folks who haven't been part of the subgroup discussion, that walking through some of the details would be helpful.
Sure. I sent out a copy of this draft last night, so I hope everybody has it, or else you're looking at it on the screen. And I wrote an initial draft. Then Jonathan turned it into a prettier version, which I then went through and copy edited because I'm that kind of guy. And then made a variety of other changes based on suggestions that people made. So I think that this represents the consensus of the people who were talking about standardization. And one good point that people made is that. To distinguish between standardizing process and standardizing file contents. And there was general agreement that standardizing process was easier than standardizing file contents, presumably because the software that produces the files is fragile. So the first section is application standards, how you get ZFA in the first place. So if you could scroll down a little bit. So point one is that there is either a single place that you apply if you had a clearinghouse, or at least there's one place to find out where you apply, which has been a problem in the past, so that you can easily figure out who you apply to. Point two is that either there should be one agreement or the agreements should all be the same. Again, since the agreements are all nearly the same, this should not be a big deal. Scroll down. Whoop, hold it for a second. Yeah, point three says the registry should make it. This is sort of overlaps with point one. Some registries are big enough that, like, they have one address for application and a different address for support. And some want them by email. Some claim they want it by fax, but will in fact take a PDF attachment and so forth. So again, in the past, this has required negotiation by email. It would be nice if we're all in one place so people could just do it. And then, yeah, scroll down to number four. Yeah, we got that. And yeah, and the sign-up process, and the process itself should be the same. Should be similar. You know, you fill out the form, you submit it, however you submit it, and you get back the credentials. Okay, the next is access standards. Once you have the credentials, what are they, and how do you use them? So point five is that the credentials should be consistent. At this point, the credentials are a username, a password, and an IP address. We had some back and forth about whether the IP address is necessary, but since a lot of the registries use them now, it clearly isn't going away. At Dave's suggestion, the passwords should be hard to guess, but in fact, all the passwords I've seen have been eight-character random strings, which should be reasonably secure. Point six is how do you get the data? Most registries provided by FTP, a few provided by something else. There's some question about whether FTP, which I think is Joe Saint-Sauvé said was state-of-the-art 25 years ago, perhaps we need something more secure. If we do have something more secure, that's fine, but it should use similar credentials. Point seven is finding the server name, which actually is one of the most painful bits now. Like, there's no consistency whatsoever in the names of the servers from which you download stuff. And after a few rounds of this, it occurred to us that it would be fairly straightforward for ICANN simply to put aliases in the DNS of domainname.zfa.icann.org for all of the servers. This would be essentially the same amount of work as putting it on a web page, but has the advantage of being easy to use mechanically. Once you've gotten to the server, point eight is what is the file name called? There's a good deal of variation in that. In some cases, the files are right in the directory you log into, and in some cases, they're in a subdirectory. In most cases, it's called something like domainname.zone.gz, but in a few cases, it's called something else. So anyway, so in Section 8, I simply pick file names that are consistent with what people mostly use now. And again, some registries provide dated versions of the zone file, which is fine, in which case you simply append the date to the zone file. Point 9 is how are the files compressed? Most of them are compressed with gzip. One registry uses a different scheme called BZIP2, which compresses somewhat better, but is less widely available. So my suggestion is just use GZIP. It's good enough, and it's widely supported on many platforms. Windows people can unzip it with WinZip. Point 10 is a good point that people brought up. How often is the data updated? Is it once a day, twice a day? Is it once a week for the tiny zones? So long as it is predictable, then people know when to log in, and you don't have a lot of wasted attempts logging in and saying, oops, never mind, I already have this file. So that is points 10 and 11. Okay, I don't think any of those are very contentious, and in fact, based on the comments in the registries, it sounds like they agree. There is less agreement on what format the files should be. With one exception, every file is in the format defined in RFC 1035 or something pretty close to it, give or take one or two missing lines. .museum provides a binary stream, but we all turn that into a master file anyway. So there are basically two ideas about what you might do. One is, given that we all know how to parse the files from .com and .biz already, simply tell people you have to use the same file format as an existing registry. That's the description in point 12. The other possibility, which we went around in great detail, is to say we could define a very easy-to-parse format. And again, the format does not affect the sort of the semantic content of the records. I mean, we all agree that the file should contain all of the records from the zone. But it turns out that RFC 1035 gives you a lot of flexibility about how you format it. You can have fields that can be omitted, in which case, so in some cases, they default to what was on the previous line, or in some cases, they default into what was in a control line some other place in the file. It has arcane rules for how you have long lines with continuations. And these simply make it harder to parse. So in line 13, with some help from ICANN staff, we came down with here is a proposed format that we think everybody could generate and everybody could use. It basically says everything is explicit. You don't use everything that might be defaulted is written out explicitly. Everywhere there is optional white space, you simply put in one space. And the goal here is that this is a valid zone file that can be parsed by everybody's parser, but it's also a simple enough format that for people who are just using casual text searching tools like grep, this makes it possible to find things easily using grep without having to go through and hand edit and write extra scripts.
Can I ask two questions?
Sure.
And they are, does your proposal make the zone file larger or smaller? And the second question is, how do you address DNSSEC in your proposed format, and does that normally fit within the specification?
Oh, the first question is the uncompressed file would be somewhat larger since the stuff that is defaulted would be written out. My guess is the compressed file would be about the same size since compression schemes do a really good job of squeezing out repeated strings. So my guess is that in terms of the actual data that people would transfer when downloading, it would not be a significant issue. As far as DNSSEC goes, those are just records in the zone file. I mean, if you download .org or .museum now, you get the DNSSEC records, and I don't anticipate that changing.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Point 14 says that a few TLDs are really hard to parse, like .name, so please don't do that. On the last page, which is stuff that Jonathan wrote and I fixed up a little bit, point 15 is there's a lot of interest in people who would like to just download the changes rather than downloading the whole file every day. However, we had basically no agreement on what do you mean by just the changes. In some cases, we want mechanical changes so we can regenerate exactly what the file would have been. In other cases, we want the changes we're interested in, like the changes to name servers or changes to IP addresses and stuff. So rather than recommending some range of diff files to be produced by registries, point 16 suggests that we simply allow one licensee to provide data to another, and they can make whatever arrangements they want. Going back to Rick's questions earlier on, we probably need some control over this so that the registries know who is providing data to whom, so if they detect abuse, they know who to complain to. But I always assumed that when you signed up, you would say if you were going to get data from someone else, who would it be? So I think we can address that. And point 17 is really already addressed, but there was some thought that we might want to leave out stuff that we thought would never change. And Jonathan, I think, pointed out, like, we hope this is going to last for decades. Anything might change, so everything has to be explicit. And I reflected that back in the suggestions in part 13. So the first half of these are basically administrative. The second half of it is eye-glazingly boring technical stuff. But I think it's all implementable, and I think none of it is a huge change from current practice. And I think that if we do it, it'll make life easier both for the registries providing the files and for us consumers who are using them. Questions?
John, thank you. This is Vladimir. I think you did an excellent job. The group did an excellent job, and I think it's a very interesting document. What I would like to do, I think it's reasonable to ask for some early feedback from the registries, because the document contains a lot of purely technical information, and I'm not sure if the members of the group here are all very well know all these intricacies of the protocols and stuff. So do you or do any other member of the group have any objections if I circulate this standardization document to the registries, to the registry stakeholder group, asking for if they have any serious objections or if anything anything said in this document breaks something in their system or whatever.
As far as I'm concerned, that would be great. I hope you do it. Does anybody else object?
I agree, Vladimir. I think that's it's a good idea.
Okay, I will do that.
Yeah. Great idea, Vladimir.
When you do ask, if you could put some time commitment around a response, that would be helpful too. Like if we give it to them in the next day or two, if they could get back to us within 4 or 5 working days or sooner, it's good to have that input sooner rather than later, obviously.
Well, I do not expect that they from the first glance, everything is fine. But as I said, I'm not an expert in these things. Therefore, I do not expect that any really serious changes will be needed. I therefore thought I could give a 2-week time frame because we're having the Register Stakeholder Group has its next meeting on Wednesday, 2 weeks after. So this will be one day before our call. This is what my plan was.
Okay. Yeah, I have a version. I want to send out a new version that has one minor change that describes how you handle TLDs that break up the zone into multiple files. But I'll send that out right after the call, and it's not very different.
Okay.
Send that out.
Thanks. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, I think Vladimir's idea to share it with trees is good. I think if there are additional comments or questions that folks within the group have, either within the subgroup or the larger group, that please submit those on the list. We're now an hour into our call and have about a half hour left, so what I'd like to do, unless there are any objections, is go to the document that Dave circulated and pull that up. And I have to step away from the phone for 1 minute, but I'm going to let Dave go ahead and start talking, and I'll be right back.
Okay, I think Craig is referring to a document that is entitled A Hybrid ZFA Model that Embraces Elements of the Clearinghouse and Enhanced Bilateral Model. What I've attempted to do in just listening to several weeks and observing multiple threads on the list is try to tease out the two tensions that most seem to be at play here. And the first tension is that on the consumer side, it would be nice to be able to simplify certain aspects of the process, especially in anticipation of larger numbers of TLDs. And so reducing contractual overheads, reducing credential and access management, fall into that category. There's also, a value in, as we've just finished discussing, normalizing data. And this is historically the case in almost any data collection, same for sharing phishing and spam feeds. It was the same for sharing call detail records among telephone companies. So, it's just always a goal where you have multiple consumers of certain kinds of data. I think it's fair to it's fair that the consumers ask for these things, so that there's a little bit more optimality in the way that that they deal with zone data, especially in the advent of potentially larger numbers of TLDs. I think it's also true that there's no reason why all this should add prohibitive costs to registries. And there's exploring ways for them to maintain oversight over over who touches the data and what the data looks like and how it's delivered is a fair statement on their part. So trying to keep them those two things in balance, what I looked at sort of carefully was the four models and realizing that that even though I proposed some of the proxy models because they have some appeal as a security professional and they have appeal in other environments like extranets, they probably are a little bit more heavy-handed. And John's Clearinghouse proposal really started to look a little bit more appealing, especially when placed in tandem with the enhanced bilateral notion. So if you try to marry those two, the idea that I had was that you would separate, nominally two, but perhaps three distinct agents, and whether they're physical entities or business entities is not necessarily a big differentiator for me at the moment. But you need someone who does all the registration and contractual processing and credential issuing. And then you also need someone to run the authentication service. And then in tandem with those two, it's possible to shed a significant amount of the operational overhead and the business overhead onto a trusted third party, and then allow the registries to focus on delivering the data and protecting the data, managing the data, and perhaps coming to some agreements on conventions for what the data would look like, specifically some forms of normalization, similar to what John's standardization discussions and paper present. So fundamentally, that's the proposal. And in the three-page paper that I sent out, I kind of walk through the roles of the registration service agent, which include processing applications, forwarding applications to the registries for approval, returning the exceptions, rejections, notifications, and then for approved applicants, issuing credentials, explaining to, providing documentation like how-tos on accessing the zone data from the selected registries, which is essentially providing the configuration information that innates from the ZFA standardization subgroup, access methods, server names, protocol service, cast to files, compression type, update intervals, and the like. So the other aspect of what the registration service agent would do is then become the IDM, the identity manager, for the registries. He would deal with password recovery resets, token replacement, change of IP, resolution, resolving problems, and then he would also be the single point for customer care and problem resolution and revocation. So if a registry determines that a consumer has violated terms of service, he simply shuts it off, notifies the, shuts that consumer off, notifies the zone file access agent, and when the complaint comes in saying I don't have access anymore, the ZFA has a response saying, hey, you know what, you violated the agreement, the registry doesn't want to allow you to deal with this, and if there are disputes, paths, then the agent would advise about the dispute paths. So then, I also talk in some detail about the authentication service model. I use, in this case, kind of a generic description of the way the RADIUS protocol behaves, but this could be a little bit more lightweight, as John Levine posted on the mailing list. It could be something where credentials could be fetched over some time interval and then cached, since there isn't a particular high frequency of drop deads and changes in this particular identity space. This could be run by a company specializing in identity management service. It could be identity as a service kind of cloud operators. I'm sure we can go on and find out if there's an outsourcing cost that we could use as kind of a target for understanding how much of a cost this would be. And people on this call have suggested that maybe ICANN would be the one to stand this up. If that's what the community wants, I'm certain that we could go to ICANN senior management and say, the community has asked us to run this. We need to factor in our budget. Let's figure out how we would run it and how much it would cost. Personal feeling is that having built authentication environments like the scale of this, where you have 1,000, 1,500 consumers, you're probably not talking about a particularly large IT footprint. But I don't want to suggest that the cost is negligible. I think if there are some there are some attractive features here. I'd like to see, see whatever criticisms there are of the model posted on the list so we can discuss them. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
You know, one question I have, if I could get in queue.
Go ahead, Rick.
Is I take it there's some thought that you put into transitioning the 800 or so current consumers into this model, or would they be able to continue to use the current ZFA contracts that they have with their registries?
I was tasked with writing a transition plan, but if that's something that we need to consider next, I think that it might be possible to to port the existing credentials into into this system in the same way that one often takes a flat ASCII database of usernames and passwords off one server and incorporates it into a RADIUS server. I think the business may be a little bit more torturous than that because you've got to kind of collect contracts, and one of the goals obviously is to normalize the contracts and come have the registries do an agreement on a single one. So I agree with you that a transition plan is needed, and it would be valuable if it wasn't a particularly painful process.
To follow up with you there, Dave, so this new concept would affect all of the current ZFA users as well as prevent individual relationships with ELD?
I suppose if you want to look at it as a glass half full view, yes. I don't know what that transition would be and what the registries would want to look like. We would have to discuss and shape it. Maybe there is a legacy. If there is a legacy, I think that doesn't particularly solve some of the problems. And clearly, one of the things we're trying to understand is how to actually migrate so that we don't have, a scale problem.
So there may be organizations that would prefer to have direct relationships with the TLDs, and this model that's being proposed would preclude organizations from that kind of. If someone doesn't want to take advantage of this proposal, would they be required to only use this mechanism?
So I don't know if
I could chime in here.
Sure.
It's Craig. I think one of the, what Rick and Dave have been going back and forth on to me sounds like an implementation detail that would come in time as part of the group's ongoing work. I don't think we can answer that question now. The focus of at least this work relates to new TLDs, and I think we have to think about, opting in for existing registries. I think we need to talk about how to, operationally and technically allow current users that have access to the zones participate in this process without making it cumbersome and arduous, but again, I think these are all implementation details that we're not going to solve today on the phone. Yeah, Dave.
No, it's Rick again.
Right. So we do have a few people in the queue, by the way.
The question that I'm asking is specifically around a new TLD. If I wanted, as we have in the past, executed an agreement with the operator of that TLD, would this new capability prevent me from doing that?
So I think the answer is probably not, but I don't think we can answer that today.
Rick, I'd have to go back and look at the draft application guide to understand exactly whether the centralized zone file access is mandatory for new TLD applicants or not. I know it's mentioned in the high security TLD program. It was part of the response, in the malicious conduct executive memorandum, but frankly, I do not know the full chapter and verse of DAG version 3, and my suggestion is if you're curious about that, you could open up the PDF and search for through Zone File Access and probably find it as quickly as I can.
Yeah, I'd like to get back to the group on that when we have a little bit more time, but I do want to get there are a couple of folks who have been waiting in the queue. First is Rick Wilhelm.
Thanks, Craig. Rick Wilhelm, I'm the other Rick W. So one of the things that in looking at this that it seems like having some centralized operator of an authentication service is a big step in the direction of operational linkage, and I'm not sure that that big step of linking the operation linking operations is worth the benefit of what it's solving. So in other words, that I don't think that the common authentication service model doesn't really solve a problem. It's solving something right now that I don't think is a particular problem. Whereas this model does speak about having a centralized place to apply and be able to process the applications and things like that. But I think the operational linkage is something that adds a fair bit of complexity, and I don't think that it offers that much in the way of benefit. It's an opinion. Probably something on which folks can disagree.
Can I respond to that? This is
sure, Dave. Go ahead, Dave.
The question would be, one question would be whether a single or reduced sign-on environment would actually be valuable. And certainly the clearinghouse could be managed in a way where you could do the contractual exercise through the clearinghouse, and as part of the correspondence between the clearinghouse and the registry operators, you go and the registry operator generates credentials for the client. Of course, that does result in large numbers of identities and credentials for a consumer that may need to have access to hundreds of TLDs. So we're sort of in that kind of environment. Is a single sign-on, a reduced sign-on, valuable or not valuable for a particular user community? And probably John would be one that could answer that question better than I.
Vladimir, I think you're next in the queue.
Yeah, I have actually the same question. Do you think it's a question to ICANN folks? Do you think it's possible to get some early review of this from ICANN? Whether ICANN would be willing or preliminary willing to run any centralized service of that kind?
Well, this is something certainly that's been talked about on the list a little bit and in past calls and in our last planning call. And I think we do need to go ahead and have the internal conversation now that we've got, I'd say, a little more meat around the bones of the concepts, whether standardization or this hybrid model that Dave has put forward. We do need to go ahead and I'll lead that effort internally to get some preliminary feedback on that. I know there are folks in the group and that are skeptical about creating yet another administrative task or something for oversight within ICANN, and we would need to craft that, get those roles and responsibilities very clearly defined and get buy-in from the various parties before we would say that we could proceed with something like that. But I'll take that, Vlad, as an action item on behalf of the group.
Thanks.
So we've got just 5 minutes left in the call. I'd like to use just a minute or two to talk about the applicant guidebook, and Rod, and then maybe go back to Rod for a little bit of discussion on the cost model. With regard to the next version of the guidebook, and I met yesterday with Karen Lentz, who's was probably the principal author of the guidebook in terms of what we need to provide. And again, what we create is not what gets directly inserted into the guidebook. We'll provide our thoughts on what registry operator obligations would be under whatever model it is or combinational models it is that we propose. Also in this paper, and I'm kind of speaking to Mark directly when I make this comment, but we're also going to need to include in that paper the comments that were made in the public comment summary, and which is not a regurgitation of what the comments are, but that the group has at least discussed the issues and whether we've chosen to include them in what we put forward or whether we say that they're out of scope, you know, for the work, you know, that the group is currently doing, or we identify them as implementation details for future work. Karen's suggestion is that we do want to make sure that we address the comments in the documentation that we provide. And there may we may wind up posting this our paper kind of along the lines of the explanatory memoranda that have been posted before on various parts of the guidebook, but posting the paper for a comment, even though you know a big part of it will be used to fill in various segments within the guidebook, whether it's the general description about registry operator obligations, or whether there are elements from what we do that go directly into the registry agreement. And further, there are a number of specification-related documents that are, I won't call them appendices to the registry agreement, but they're attachments to, that we may wind up turning, you know, what John has produced with the subgroup and the group as a whole, what we may wind up taking those specifications from our paper and turning it into a spec that will be in addition to the registry agreement. So, you know, right now we'd be putting the cart before the horse to say that everything in that paper goes directly into the guidebook. But what we want to do is kind of cast a broad net with our concepts and our implementation, at least to date, as well as the specifications, and give that to ICANN. The other thing that Karen Lentz has suggested is that we bounce off of her as soon as we're ready the first draft that we have. She's got a really good eye for understanding, because of her long time at ICANN, what might be missing as it relates to materials for the guidebook. So as soon as we have something ready, we ought to bounce it off her and get her feedback so we can incorporate that to our final document. And that's all that I'll really say about that piece of work. Are there any questions about that? Seeing none. Rod, I'm not able for some reason to project your Excel spreadsheet. I've been having issues with it this morning. Do you want to spend 5 or 10 minutes kind of at a high level going through the latest version of the model and what you might like to see from the group out of it?
Okay, sure. Thanks, Craig. So I've been going back and forth on this model quite a bit, and thanks for the feedback to my subject numbers there that I've gotten. It's fairly complicated. I think that's the high-level takeaway, and that's been feedback. So the latest version of it, which I believe is the one that got sent out to the entire group, had a kind of a bottom line here, impact page. I believe I sent out an email from Tokyo now, said that I want, or maybe I just sent it out just now. It's hard for me to keep track at the moment. Talking about putting together a way of simplifying the data input process. Right now there's about 100 different shiny knobs to turn and twist to get it to put out different things. So, and this, Mikey had actually suggested this in the original that I based this off of, was having a single page to do that. He needed, just didn't have the time to do it before. And I think the level we're at now, that's where it needs to go. But the bottom line is there's an impacts page that you can take a look at based on where things stand currently if you just run things under the different models. And then you know, some future model where there's hundreds of registries and some more subscribers. And that you know, allows you to do some cost comparisons and see that, you know, there's savings. My biggest takeaway is there's savings to be had from some of the heavier weight models to the community as a whole, but not necessarily anything that's compelling to any particular registry or consumer. It's more of a you know, kind of a public good issue. Public good issues are typically handled through regulation and government rather than free market. So that, you know, that's kind of telling me that we're need to be looking for, you know, lighter weight solutions that everybody can agree on. So that's where I kind of shifted my position on where I want to go with this thing. As far as cost model going forward, I said I was going to put some simplifications in there so people could play with it easier. And you can go in underneath the model and play with the things like the fixed costs, the variable costs, the number of registries, potential registries, the number of, you know, the size of zone files, things like that. And those things will be available kind of as a refining bit so that people could play with things and change the assumptions. So that's where we're at with that.
Thanks, Rod. Any direct questions for Rod at the moment? So we're right at the top of the hour here, and what I would suggest is, since most of these documents were just posted really within the last few days, that folks chime in on the list, you know, ideally in the next day or two or three, with any kind of final comments or suggestions or edits that they have, so we could, you know, move these along in terms of their development. In the meantime, following up on Vlad's suggestion about getting the standards document out to the registries, I think it's a great idea. Would I love to have feedback sooner than 2 weeks? I think so, but I also understand that the constituency or the stakeholder group meets every 2 weeks, and that they were meeting today. Excuse me, they met yesterday. They'll meet again on the 28th. I've definitely got a couple of action items here that I will follow up on and get back to the group on the list. Is there anything else that anyone would like to cover now before we call it a day? Hearing none, thanks for everyone's participation today. Keep chatting on the list, keep up the good work, and let's keep the momentum going forward to meet our commitment to ICANN for the next version of the guidebook. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks, bud.